Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be looking at two parliamentary elections that happened on the weekend of the 14th and 15th of October, one in Poland and the other in New Zealand. And we'll be answering the big question, why did we see such a seismic change of government in Poland? It's Sunday, the 29th of October, 2023.
To be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
Joining me on the other side of the world, as always, is my co-host Chern. How's everything going, Chern? And it's worth saying before we begin, we've come full cycle. It's the first time that we'll be covering the results of an election that we have previously covered in a scheduled way on this podcast since we started it 3 years ago.
I love you had to say the word scheduled in there because certain countries have broke the rule. Looking at you, Bulgaria, Israel, for breaking the rules on scheduled elections. But yes, it did feel very nostalgic researching and looking at New Zealand again and watching their election coverage, because I remember when I was back in Singapore doing the exact same thing 3 years ago. So this does seem very much full circle, and 129 episodes later, Sam, we're a bit older, we're a bit wiser, but it's still me looking at you down a Zoom camera and recording our thoughts, isn't it?
Exactly, but you'd hardly believe it was only one term and 3 years ago, because the result, particularly in New Zealand, was so different to last time that you'd hardly believe it's only been one term.
It really is, and I think there's nowhere better way to start by diving into the results. And New Zealand's 122 House of Representatives, so therefore the magic number is 62 seats needed for a majority government. So National, whose new leader, Christopher Luxon, is almost certain to lead the sixth national-led government and be the new prime minister, where 50 seats, up 16, with 39% of the party vote, which is up 13%. The outgoing prime minister, Christopher Hipkins, and his Labour Party with 34 seats, down 28, with only 27% of the party vote, down 23%. Now, in other words, Sam, that meant that Labour lost nearly one in every two voters who voted for them in the last election, a frankly astonishing number. And National, by contrast, added for every three supporters who now voted National, one of them were new. So that's just a scale of the shift from Labour Party back to the National Party. The Greens got 14 seats, up five, with 10.8% of the party vote, up 3%. And interestingly as well, they got two extra electorate seats. They now have three electoral seats, which I think is pretty interesting. Led by David Seymour, we have 11 seats, up one, with 9% of the party vote, up 1.4%. New Zealand First, led by former Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, is back. If eight seats, they crossed the 5% threshold with 6.5% of the vote. The Maori Party, which is one of the other stories of the night, were four seats, up two, with 2.6% of the vote. Now, we should note that while that technically is under the 5% threshold, all four seats that they have are electorate seats, once a party wins an electorate seat, you do not need to hit the 5% threshold in order to enter parliament. So for listeners wondering why the Maori Party with under 5% of the vote managed to get in, it's because they won four electorates. So we'll talk about the Maori seats in a minute. Just two caveats that we need to note here. National will almost certainly get one more seat or one more electorate seat. So whether it wash on a party vote, we'll see, because the Port Waikato seat didn't happen on the 14th of October because of the death of the ACT candidate during the election. It will be a by-election. It is a safe national seat, so they will almost certainly gain an extra seat. We are talking about these results today, but we should note that the special votes have not been counted. The special votes includes overseas voters. It also includes voters who did not vote in the electorate that they voted in. So, for example, university students could be in one of the major universities in Auckland and Wellington, but they're registered back home. They voted as special votes, and the results will be released in a couple of days' time. So that usually benefits the left. But I think what we can say, Sam, before I get your... What are your reactions? And B, despite that caveat of the special votes, which I think in the last election, National dropped two seats, there's no doubt Christopher Luxon is going to be the next prime minister, isn't he?
No, not at all. And that's why we decided to proceed with it this week, because, yes, we might change some of the calculus of who needs to be around the government table, and more on that in a bit. But it shouldn't really change the fact that Christopher Luxon is pretty much guaranteed to be the new Prime Minister of New Zealand. And Chris Hipkins, the leader of the Labour Party, all but said that in his concession speech on Election Day as well. But my reactions, Chern, are that it's quite a big change since 3 years ago. And I think before we unpack everything, I think we should acknowledge that when multi-member proportional system was introduced in 1996, since then, we've only had one majority government, and that was what happened 3 years ago. So I think we should be treating any comparisons with the results 3 years ago with a little bit of an asterisk, because what happened with Jacinda Ardern and the Labour Party getting an overall majority 3 years ago was 100% an exception rather than the rule. So to put into context how close Christopher Luxon came to that overall majority line in one cycle, I think is illustrative of how well the National Party did to turn things around. But we should, in terms of the Labour fortunes, be with the asterisks of, yes, they did particularly badly in this election. Yes, they nearly lost half of their seats. But it was from a historic high, not just by New Zealand Labour standards, but by New Zealand political standards, full stop. So I think that asterisk is important. But yeah, Chern, it's an extraordinary result, because Christopher Luxon became leader in this term and has managed to turn around his party's fortunes so much that he's now the Prime Minister designate of the country. I don't think anyone expected, when Judith Collins was making her concession speech 3 years ago, that the National Party would be straight back in government and in a pretty commanding position as well.
Here's the interesting thing that I think you just talk about the scale of the change. Do you know which election Christopher Luxon became an MP?
3 years ago?
3 years ago. He only became an MP 3 years ago. And within that space of time, he became leader of the opposition and now prime minister. Let's just put that in perspective in terms of the scale of the huge, there's no other way of saying it, rebound for the National Party. And I think what you just said about the context of how unique the last election and how different it was in the MMP era is absolutely correct. I've got a fun fact I'd like to ask you. There have been six prime ministers, Sam, that since World War II. So that'd be Chris Hipkins, Jenny Shipley, in the fourth Labour government as well, who took over a party, Bill Rowling as well, who took over the party midterm. How many of them have won re-election for their party?
I feel like you're asking me that question because the answer is either one or zero. So I'm going to go with zero.
So if we ignore the first election after World War II, the answer is zero. So no party in post-World War II, where we saw a new prime minister take over from an incumbent, from a prime minister who led the party to victory the election before, has won another term for their party. So was
Chris Hipkins doomed to fail from the moment he took over from Jacinda Ardern?
Well, I think when we dissect the results later, I think to a certain extent, he could have done a bit better. But at the same time, you know, all the scandals that Labour, you know, we talked about the ministerial resignations, the four ministerial resignations. if they had come out, you know, if they had come out regardless of whoever was leading the government, I don't think you could save it, really. And particularly we're seeing, you know, the cost of living crisis, the general anti-incumbency mood. I don't think you could have really changed those fundamentals, can you, Sam?
No, and I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago when we previewed this election, but you had a situation where one of the key elements was the backlash to the COVID restrictions, because obviously New Zealand had some of the toughest COVID restrictions in the world. And not only was Chris Hipkins unable to shed that because it was his Labour government that put them in, but he himself was the COVID minister. So he found that an impossible situation to shed. And that combined with the severe housing shortage, rising cost of living, high inflation, in comparison to a national party that was promising tax cuts and a refocus of the objective of the National Bank, I think it was a situation in which Chris Hipkins just really struggled to compete with that narrative.
I do think you're right. The context, particularly when they were elected in 2020, as it turns out, the pandemic was far from over, isn't it? And you talked about one of the key factors. I actually, looking at these results, I actually think COVID and the lockdowns, particularly in Auckland, and as you said, Chris Hipkins was the minister for the COVID-19 response. You cannot run away being that being a reason why Labour did so badly, because it was really, and I think let's just not look at the party vote, but let's look at how they performed in the electorates. Because Sam, the performance of the New Zealand Labour Party, some of the Auckland electorates, I cannot believe my eyes in terms of how badly Labour did in some of what we thought was the traditional strongholds. Mount Roskill, which was the seat held by the former Foreign and Defence Minister, Phil Goff. So Michael Wood lose his seat, and because he's only got a 40, he was 40th on the list, he's out of Parliament completely, something I didn't expect him to be losing that seat.
Yeah, and he's one of four people who'd served in the Labour cabinet over the last 6 years to have lost their seats. I mean, one of the most extraordinary results, I think, is Nanaia Mahuta's loss, the foreign minister who has been an MP since 1996 and lost to the Māori Party, not just, but actually the Māori Party majority in that seat now is nearly 2,000 votes, I think.
Yes, and the Māori seats, we should say, are a lot smaller in population. So 2,000 vote is a bloody big deal. Sam, then the new MP, the new Māori Party in who replaced Nanaia Mahuta, do you know which year she was born? She's 21 years old. She was born in 2002. So in other words, she was born after Nanaia Mahuta became an MP while she was a minister.
Wow.
That's wow. The extent to which Nanaia Mahuta's, and I don't think you can, I think in Nanaia Mahuta, I don't think she's performed very well as foreign minister. And obviously as foreign minister, you spend a lot of time out of your electorate. And I think that hurt her.
Yeah, I should just clarify. I think the majority is 1,366, but still, for the foreign minister to lose the seat by that majority, as you said, in quite a small seat, is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, going back to the Auckland, I want to talk about the Maori seats in a minute because I think that's really interesting. But just talk about Auckland, New Lynn, for example, another seat held by former leader David Cunliffe, been Labour since 1963. Deborah Russell appears to have lost the seat of 483 votes, but I think that could be still overturned on special votes. But we do know other cabinet ministers who have lost their seats. Willie Jean Prine, Damien O'Connor, Priyanka Radhakrishnan, Kieran McEnulty, Ginny Anderson. That's, you know, five cabinet ministers. It was a complete bloodbath, yeah, and Phil, in Labour and electorates.
Phil Twyford actually lost his Tier Atatu seat by just 30 votes. So he'll be particularly disappointed as well.
But I would say the caveats, I think 30 votes could be overturned on special. So I think, and if you're a Labour MP who lost a seat and your majority is three figures, you have lost a seat, I would say don't rule out your chances of coming back.
Don't be reviewing the CV immediately.
Not quite. I think anyone who has lost by four figures, you probably would be reviewing the CV, but anybody less than three figures, you still have a chance. So there's still a chance for Damien O'Connor, Deborah Russell, for example, Tracy McKellen in Banks Peninsula, Rachel Boyer in Nelson and Teatro 2. So there are a couple of choices. But Sam, did you see the result in Mount Albert, Jacinda Ardern's former seat?
I didn't, no.
Mount Albert, so for this is the seat that has been Labour held since 1946. It was a seat formerly held by Helen Clark, David Shearer, and Jacinda Ardern, three former Labour leaders. In the last election, Jacinda Ardern won 70% of the vote and with a 21,000 majority. The new candidate, Helen White, well, the majority is 106.
I think that's a big illustration of how Labour fortunes have changed in the last 3 years.
Yeah, the no, there cannot be anything like that. But Sam, there's also been a bloodbath in the Maori seats. You hinted about that, but Labour also performed badly in some of the other Maori seats, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And I think the Maori Party will be particularly pleased with their performance. As you said, they've now got four electorate seats, which not just affects their personal fortunes, but also affects the fortunes of the opposition. Because what it does mean, because the Maori seats got more electorates, the Maori Party got more electorates than they would have got under the proportional system, the size of the parliament actually increases, which disadvantages Christopher Luxon, because it does mean that he'll need even more allies to get over the line. So that it's actually had a much bigger impact than just on the parties contesting those seats as well. But no, they've had a great result. I mean, Nai Mahuta's seat was overturned, now has a nearly 1,500 majority. They've also overturned Te Tai Hanauru. That will now have a 6,340 majority. So this is pretty huge results. And we also have the Te Tai Tonga seat, which nearly has a 1,500 majority. So they have been winning these seats in quite spectacular fashion as well.
Yeah, and Te Tai Tonga, you saw another minister defeated, Reno Tiratini. The speaker was defeated in Te Tai Hauoru. So big names in the Maori Labour caucus were decimated tonight. And even their deputy, the Labour deputy leader, Kelvin Davis, has survived by only 487 votes. So I think what is interesting to me is that this election, there can be no doubt, we've spent, you know, the good part of 10 minutes talking about this, the tide has gone out for Labour. And that vote has sprayed all over the place. And in the Maori Party, and the Maori voters, they've clearly gone back to the Maori Party as well. But I think the challenge for the Maori Party, which I don't agree, Sam, is that in an election where Labour definitely looked like it was on the way out and the signs were there, I wonder if a lot of Maori voters could feel safer or much more willing to park their vote elsewhere. But when the tide comes back in for Labour, and it inevitably will, the question is how loyal will these Maori voters be? Because we saw it in 2017, you know, Labour cleaned up the Maori electorates when Jacinda Ardern came back and was first elected Prime Minister in 2020. They only lost one. They lost four seats as well. I think five even in 2008. But by 2017, when they were back in government, they want it all back. I think the challenge for the Maori Party is to not just be the whole of disillusioned Maori when the Labour Party is down. It has to maintain that. And I haven't seen any evidence of that happening so far.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's also the wider context of the region, not just in New Zealand, is obviously we talked about the referendum in Australia. There does seem to be some tide turning against suggestions that tide could turn against indigenous populations. So I wonder if that could be interesting context for the Maori Party moving forwards, in Maori people thinking, well, we need to look out for our own interests by voting for these parties, because clearly in Australia, we can't rely on the bigger parties to be able to do that and deliver for our agenda. So I wonder if we'll start to see that kind of politics trickle into New Zealand, because that is interesting context as well.
I think so too. I think you're absolutely right that maybe the demands for Maoridom and what they want have changed over the last 3 years. You cannot ignore that. And maybe the most centrist nature that Chris Hipkins took the government might have harmed them in some of the Maori seats. I want to talk about some of the other parties who won electorate seats. Before we talk about National and what their options are, What are your reactions to the Greens winning Grant Robertson's former seat of Wellington Central and Julianne Jenta taking over in Rongotai? So they have two seats in Wellington now. And ANC's deputy leader, Brooke Van Walden, taking out Simon O'Connor and Tamaki. Now, I understood in Tamaki, the reason why in which ANC decided, Brooke Van Walden decided to stand as a candidate was that even though it's a safe national seat, before this hand, it was national since 1960. So this is national royalty seat, was because of her frustration with Simon O'Connor over abortion and his votes on the euthanasia. So challenging him on the social issue front. But what is your reaction to even the electorates? And it does seem to me that if you just look at the general electorates, that Labour and National can't really take all these electorates for granted, isn't it?
No, I mean, I think on the Green front, there's a similar story going on to what happened in the Maori electorates, I think, which is that people who are of more leftist traditions in New Zealand felt like they didn't owe the Labour Party any loyalty in this election because the Labour Party weren't going to form the next government. So I think a lot of people maybe felt like they could lend their votes to parties that were ideologically closer to them on more issues rather than voting for the next prime minister, because it did seem for most of this campaign that Christopher Hipkins was going to lose this election. So I think some Green Party voters who traditionally would have voted Labour to make sure that Labour get into government felt like they didn't need to do that this time around because it wasn't going to make a huge difference. So I think that does form a large part of the Green Party story, in my opinion, in this election. Whereas I think particularly in Tamaki, I think it is a very much locally driven result for Buck Van Velden. But saying that, it has been a strong election for the ACT Party. So for them to walk away with an additional electorate seat, I think is testament to the strength of campaign they had throughout this election and why that they will be emerging as a very strong participant in the next federal government.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask, actually, because do you think ACT will be slightly disappointed by these results? Because at 9% of the vote, 8.6%, that was their vote did trend down as election day approached, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But I think they'll be mostly happy with this result because it's their best ever vote share, highest ever seat count. Since 2008, they haven't had more than one seat in the New Zealand Parliament. So. And also that they expected and will play a large role in the formation of this next government. And David Seymour is likely to have a large role in this coming cabinet. So they might be disappointed that throughout this campaign, they were polling much higher and were projected at one point to get about 17 seats, which would have been an extraordinary result for ACT Party in one of the projections. But I think they'll still be pleased to have this kind of large role and to restore them to the kind of seat counts that they were getting in the last 20 years. So they might be slightly disappointed that this one got away from them a little bit, but I think they'll be happy with the end result.
Yeah, and I think, you know, David Seymour could be the next Deputy Prime Minister. And you know, you're right. I think particularly in a multi-member proportional system, like it whether or not, I think winning an electorate does give you an extra sense of legitimacy in a way compared to if you're a list MP. So definitely their reputation has been enhanced by winning a second electorate. And, you know, National had to help out ACT during its lean years in the national government by essentially running dead in Epsom, which is David Seymour's electorate. So now they have a second chance or a second option to go through if for whatever reason David Seymour loses his Epsom seat. So, and this is the first time ACT has won two electorates, and I don't think that could be discounted either.
No, absolutely. So Chern, there's quite a lot up in the air ahead of Friday's release of the special votes, but as we've said, it's very unlikely that anyone but Christopher Luxon will be the Prime Minister and the National will be leading the government. But what could be determined is who he needs to work with. Because at the moment, the National plus the ACT Party are pretty much sat on the majority line. So it does seem increasingly likely that in some way they will need to have conversations with New Zealand First. So what do you think this government looks like? And are those conversations with New Zealand First straightforward?
Yeah, they have 62 seats now. I think that because I'm assuming Port Waikato, that will bring them to National Act 62. I'm assuming they will therefore drop below that. And therefore, I think Winston Peters will be involved in some kind. Now, this is where it gets dangerous for Winston Peters, because he's been in government or supported three governments. In 1996, he supported a national government. In 2005 and 2017, he supported Labour governments. What happened in the last two times he supported a Labour government, or and even in and to a lesser extent in 1996? His party got wiped out in the last two elections, and his party more than halved in 1996. So he has to be very careful about how he treads in this coalition negotiations. Maybe if he has a longer term view of what might happen, he might consider a confidence and supply arrangement and be slightly more removed from the day-to-day decision-making. So to criticize the government where it doesn't see fit and to more advocate his interests. He might take a ministerial responsibility. He was foreign minister, for example, under a confidence supply agreement in Helen Clark, whilst remaining minister outside cabinet, didn't quite understand how that worked. I suspect a looser form of arrangement might be in for now than in 2017 when he went to a full coalition with the Labour Party, because I don't see that happening now. Because if he's concerned about long-term survival of the party. But put it this way, in 2017, Winston Peters was the kingmaker because he could decide which way to go. Could he go to the National Party or could he go to the Labour Party? He doesn't have that kind of power now, because even if he sides with Labour, they have to put a completely unwieldy coalition together. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's the key difference, is that New Zealand First probably will be involved in these discussions, but they don't hold all the cards in the way that they have done in the past. So I wouldn't rule out a situation where the National and ACT parties form a coalition and decide to have a minority coalition, just assuming that along the way they'll get some sort of arrangements with other people. So it's not completely off the cards that that happens. But I do think there is an interesting potential cooperation between ACT and New Zealand First, because I think they do share quite a number of populist principles on certain policy areas. So I don't think, because I think it's quite easy for external viewers to think that the ACT party is sort of your like Liberal Democrat equivalent, but it's not that at all. It's actually on quite a lot of principles further right than the National Party. So you're the New Zealand First and ACT might actually be more conventional bedfellows than New Zealand First and the National Party. So that will be an interesting dynamic, because they share some populist principles on Indigenous rights, some more social issues as well. So it could be an interesting discussion. And I don't think it's going to be quite as alien between those two parties as one might first assume.
It will be, because David Seymour and Winston Peters hate each other personally. So whilst the policy platform might overlap, personalities, they do not like each other. So, you know, but who knows? Politics could be very strange. But I have to admit, Sam, I don't buy your theory about potentially a minority government. Whilst New Zealand has innovated a lot, I'm a bit more skeptical about it. For the same reason, look at Germany. I just don't see MMP environments, particularly such like New Zealand, producing a minority. Whilst they've had minority governments, they've always had confidence and supply with enough parties to bring them all across the majority line. There could be a National Act minority government, but there will be some kind of confidence arrangement. I don't think they want something where they're a wimp to Winston Peters with every single vote. That's my view.
Interesting. Interesting.
And finally, just a quick word, Sam. I do feel a bit sorry for Chris Hipkins. He took over what was an impossible task. But you cannot deny that I think 27% of the vote was probably at the lower end of the Labour Party's expectations. As they head into opposition, he will be the leader of the opposition for a while. I think understandable, given he's only been Prime Minister for 10 months. What's next for Labour?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, because I'm not entirely sure. I'd be incredibly surprised if Chris Hipkins led the Labour Party into the next general election. But I think one thing that benefits him is that there's no clear successor presenting themselves yet, because remember, he was elected unopposed back in January. The only other names that were really touted at the time were the Deputy Prime Minister Grant Robertson and the Deputy Leader of the party, Calvin Davies. I can't really see either of those people challenging him this time around. And the only other name talked about last time was Kiri Allen. Well, we know what happened to Kiri Allen over the course of this parliament is she had to resign in scandal, and then it followed with a significant loss of her seat in the East Coast. So really, I think the only other prominent figure in the party who could potentially be a replacement is Carmel Cepelloni, but it's not clear whether she even wants this position at all. So I think the soul searching for Labour is going to take some time. I think Chris Hipkins is advantaged by the fact that there isn't that obvious successor available. And I think actually a Labour leadership contest in this moment would be fascinating, because there could be some quite left field candidates presenting themselves for this role, given that 9 months ago, Chris Hipkins was elected unopposed, and most of the obvious successors to him probably won't run.
Well, I did hear Michael Wood talked about as the leader of the opposition, but that's not going to happen. I think Kieran McEnulty was also talked about as a potential leader of the opposition, but he lost his electorate seat. He'll be back on the list, but I think he lost a lot of legitimacy and momentum trying to get there. I agree he's helped by the fact there's no obvious contender. I think Labour, when it went into opposition in 2008, Helen Clark resigned on election night. I think that was a mistake this time, last time. So I think Chris Hipkins has made it better by not resigning on election night and allowing some kind of continuity. After all, he was the preferred prime minister, albeit barely, heading to. He has some kind of baseline popularity with the New Zealand public. But what I think is more concerning for Labour is that they have 17 electorates now and 17 list MPs. The 17 list MPs, Sam, largely consists of politicians who lost their electorate seats and now on the list. In other words, there's no new talent within the Labour Party.
Yeah, and it's not going to be the reset that parties need after this calamitous defeat. So it will be very interesting, I think. I think there could be some names that haven't been talked about that come forward and present themselves as potential leaders. But I mean, my hunch, Chern, to end this section on New Zealand, is I think this Labour recovery is going to take more than one term.
Well, we said that on National, didn't we? So, who knows?
Stranger things have happened.
And the one consolation for this is that Jacinda Ardern became an MP in 2008 when Labour lost power. Look where that turned out for Labour.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. We're now going to be diving into the other consequential parliamentary election held over the last few weeks in Poland, where the Donald Tusk-led opposition will very likely, almost inevitably, be replacing the incumbent Law and Justice Party as the leading government of Poland, with a pretty commanding majority in the Sejm achieved a few weeks ago. So there are 460 seats overall in the Sejm, with 231 required for a majority. Well, the Law and Justice Party did get the most seats in this election, with their United Right coalition getting 194 seats, but crucially that's down 41 seats and over 8% of the vote, leaving the Civic Coalition-led side of the debate in Poland in a position with 248 seats overall. The Civic Coalition themselves got 157, up 23 and up 3% of the vote. The Third Way got 65 seats, which is nearly doubling their seat count from last time, with an increase of nearly 6% of the vote. The Left, although falling back on seats to 26, still got 8.6% of the vote. And those three groups together, the Civic Coalition, Third Way and the Left, sit, as I said, on 248 seats, which will be an overall majority in the same. And although the process, as we'll talk about in a second, is likely to take some time, it's incredibly likely that Donald Tusk will become Prime Minister of Poland again, and the opposition will be in control, ending 8 years of law and justice control in Poland. So, Chern, quite an extraordinary result, really, in the global context, quite a consequential result in the global context. What are your reactions? Did you expect this?
Honestly, no. I think we spent a lot of the time, you know, talking about the alleged unfair playing field in Poland. And honestly, the results were a bit of a surprise. I don't think, looking at the headline results, I'm not entirely surprised by the performance of PIS nor PO. I think they largely conform to what I expected. But to see Confederation with only a 0.4% increase in their vote, and to see Third Way clearly in third place, I think the story of the election is not necessarily how the two big coalitions have performed, but how the Third Way, the Left, and Confederation have performed, don't you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the big stories of this election, particularly when you compare it to other similar elections in Europe over the last few years, is the fact that it was the opposition coalition parties that did well, rather than Donald Tusk's party in particular doing extraordinarily well and sweeping him into power alone. And I think that is one of the big stories here. But I think you're absolutely right. I think people were suggesting that there was a possibility of the opposition winning this election, but I think people thought the combination of the unlevel playing field, the alleged unlevel playing field, the dominance of the Law and Justice Party in the last few elections, and also, let's be frank, the disappointment of similarly like-minded people in Hungary last year was going to lead to a situation where the Law and Justice Party again snuck through into power. So I think people are, all over the world, reeling from what was quite an extraordinary election 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no better way to put it that way. And let's start with how they managed to do it, because we talked about the referendum. I'll talk about the referendum towards the end later. We talked about PIS stacking the field, particularly against the judiciary, the election courts, the dominance of the media. How on earth did they manage to win this election?
Well, I think there's a few factors here. I think one has to be turnout, because this turnout in this election at 74.4%, as the recorded figure at the moment, is by far the largest turnout in the Third Polish Republic. I mean, the second highest was 61.7% 4 years ago, and prior to that, it had hovered around 50%. So 74.4% is extraordinarily high turnout, and it was particularly motivated by two groups of people who have historically turned out in lower numbers. And those groups, young people and women, by far turned out in large numbers for the opposition coalition parties, particularly Donald Tusk's Civic Coalition. I mean, I've got some stats here, Chern. Yes, the Law and Justice Party won both the male demographic and female demographic by winning this overall election. But amongst men, Law and Justice had a 7-point lead. Amongst women, that lead was just 3%. And the changeover from in age at which people voted for Law and Justice rather than the Civic Coalition was the over 50s category. 4 years ago, they had a lead in all age categories from 18 upwards. And this one, I think, is the biggest for me, is that there was a huge turnout in urban areas. So the turnout was 80% plus in areas that had a population of over 200,000 people. In rural areas, it was barely 70%. So that is like a 10% margin in turnout in higher density population areas, which in big numbers voted mostly for the opposition coalition partners. And here's the other one, non-voters. 27% of 2019 non-voters voted for the Civic Coalition, 19% of them for the Third Way, and just 14% for the Law and Justice Party. So those people who turned out afresh this time around, by far, voted for the Third Way and Civic Coalition. So I think the story of this election, if you want to pinpoint why the opposition parties did well, is that they juiced turnout and got people to come out. Their message about optimism and the need to save Polish democracy really hit home. And they got a lot of people to turn out who, not just in the last 4 years, but in the last 30 years, have opted not to vote in Polish elections. And I think it's kind of an extraordinary story about democracy, really.
Well, for me, my stats was about the youth vote, actually, about why this election was won, because turnout for 8 voters aged 18 to 29 reached 68.9%, whilst it's less than 74%. We should note they only 46.4% only voted in 2019. So a 20 percentage point increase plus in terms of the share of youths that bothered to vote. And what happened to the support for the ruling party? It fell to 15% from 26.3% 4 years earlier. So they suffered from the combination of a lower vote share and more people voting. So I think that proved to be a big thing. And we should note that we often think in the West that youth voters are much more center-left, much more centrist in its ideas. We should note that the youth vote has proved crucial in past election outcomes, and youth vote are more willing to swing the other way. The key thing is, of course, in 2007, the youth voters helped Donald Tusk and Civic Coalition beat Kaczynski's PIS in a snap election that year. And in 2015 as well, where the youth vote came out in what they thought was out-of-touch civic platform establishment propelling PIS into government. So we should know that the youth in Poland are not stick-on, rusted, like in the UK or the US Democratic or Labour Party vote. They are swing voters, but that is, to me, pretty interesting.
Jen, I'd love your thoughts also on a couple of other reasons I came up with. Firstly, I think Donald Tusk is an interesting story here because we talked last time about how he's not a particularly popular character, or hasn't been in recent years, because he's seen as quite like an archetypal establishment figure. Some of the records of the latter days of his government are critiqued quite heavily, and is one of the reasons why we ended up in this 8 years of law and justice control. And yet we had a situation where Donald Tusk, in his central Warsaw constituency, got nearly 350,000 personal votes, which, according to the coalition figures, is a record for any individual candidate in any Polish election in any constituency in the Third Republic, which I think is quite extraordinary for him as an individual candidate. But the other thing is, I wonder if the fact that we had three relatively politically diverse options for opposition voters is one of the reasons they did well here, because there were, for people of different ideological backgrounds who disliked what the Law and Justice Party had been doing in Poland, they had an option of somewhere to go. I think this is mostly seen, or pretty starkly seen, in the issue of abortion, social issues, because the left party and the Civic Coalition broadly support liberalisation of abortion up to 12 weeks. Whereas the Third Way Party, they do want to reverse outlawing abortion in case of birth defects, but any further liberalisation of abortion laws they want to put to a referendum, and have been quite candid over whether they as a party would support it or not. So if you were someone who was quite conservative, I mean, Poland has quite a heavy Catholic community. If you're someone who's quite conservative on abortion issues, you may have felt uncomfortable voting for the Civic Coalition if that was your only opposition option, but you would have been maybe much happier putting your cross in the Third Way box, knowing that one of your core principles on abortion was not going to be compromised as a result. And I think that's one of the reasons why the opposition was able to do much better than its counterparts in Hungary, because they chose to run as one huge list. This time they chose to run as three independent lists who all did well.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I was about to bring up, have they learned from what the mistakes of the opposition in Hungary? Because I definitely think, if you look at abortion, as you quite eloquently described, that options for, on a big issue of cleavage, you had options for different parties to consider. So I definitely think that you're absolutely right that having those options was particularly key. And they probably did learn from the Hungary example in trying to unseat a government who has been accused of authoritarian nature as well. The other thing relating to Donald Tusk is, I think both Donald Tusk and Jarosław Kaczynski has inspired great loyalty and great hatred, depending on what your worldview is. Jarosław Kaczynski, I think, and because Donald Tusk base of support is very much concentrated in urban areas, he would naturally get a lot more vote on a personal vote than he would have otherwise have done. And what I think is particularly interesting is that I think a lot of it cases, because he's so well known as a political figure, particularly if you're pro-European, you're probably very pro-Tusk, is that I don't think he potentially would have won any additional voters, but if he would have probably redistributed how the PO vote, the civic platform vote, was redistributed in civic in central Warsaw, there could be a much more concentration on the civic platform vote in Donald Tusk because he's the lead candidate, therefore allowing him to by far get the most personal vote because it's the most high profile. So I think there are caveats around that. Both Donald Tusk and Jarosław Kaczyński inspire great love and amongst his supporters and great hatred by the opposition.
And I think there is an element here to, it's important to say that the Law and Justice vote, they did win this election in terms of winning the most votes and the most seats. So it wasn't a complete collapse of their support. But nonetheless, I think there were some mistakes made by them that contributed to this result as well. I think the referendum is certainly one of them, because I think a lot of people saw through that and saw that as a blatant attempt to unlevel this playing field going to this election. I think the other one, which I was reading about, was about one of their sort of electioneering moves was for the state-owned petrol corporation to cut fuel prices for the duration of the election so that people felt like cost of living was cheaper when they were going to the polls to vote for the next election. But what actually ended up happening was people saw through this as an electioneering move, rushed to the petrol stations to stockpile fuel, and actually there was panic buying and fuel shortages, which later the government denied were even happening in the first place. So I think you had a few examples throughout this campaign of exactly what Tusk and the opposition were saying was happening, people could see happening in their lives, and the kind of antics that the Law and Justice Party had been pursuing over the last 8 years, I think, came to fore in quite a desperate campaign to win a third term. So I think it was interesting that maybe the Civic Coalition did put out quite a strong campaign and Donald Tusk should be credited for that and the opposition win. But I think there is an element of the Law and Justice Party also losing a little bit of control over this narrative as well.
I should, one more thing to add to that. Apparently the day before the election, they appointed 72 judges. Could they see the writing on the wall of what was potentially going to happen? That's something which will be interesting. On the mistakes that the PIS made, over the last 4 years, I had a look back to the opinion polls over the last 4 years, and you cannot help but, if you look at it, Sam, there's a big drop. They were polling in the 40s until August to October 2020, when it fell to 35%. And as we've seen, whatever they've done over the last 3 years, the government hasn't recovered from that point. And so therefore, I started to look at what could influence the result, what caused a big fall, and what prevented them from rising from that big fall. So what we did see in August, September was, of course, the presidential election in 2020, which re-elected President Duda. I think what was more interesting was three issues which impacted PIS during this period. Firstly, the Supreme Court, which was already stacked by PIS supporters at this point, on the 24th of October, tightened abortion restrictions, which of course made a lot of women voters very angry. And Sam, you just eloquently say what the impact of making the women voters angry was in terms of how they voted in this election. Secondly, it was obvious, this was when a concern about Poland's treatment of the LGBTQ community was reaching its was starting to reach its crescendo. And I think a lot of people I was reading saw that as potentially a step too far from PIS. And I think some of the other social issues, which it kind of kept hidden in its first term in government, were really becoming to the fore, particularly after President Duda was elected. And the third thing I don't think we can discount was the extent that in August, because of the presidential election and because of the fact that people became mobilized, complacency from the government set in, COVID hit Poland particularly hard. There was inconsistent messaging because the government needed particularly elderly people to get to the polls, so they were less disciplined about mask wearing and social distancing. It led to the point where in November, Poland had the fourth highest COVID-19 death rate in the EU, and more cases per million than France. Hospitals were overwhelmed, and therefore they were forced to implement a second lockdown. So we talked in New Zealand about the Auckland lockdown. We saw the electoral impact that had.
I don't think we can think that COVID reared its political, long political shadow in this election, despite the fact it wasn't on the agenda whatsoever.
No, I think you're absolutely right on all three of those things. And I think we just saw in the US in the 2022 midterms just how powerful a motivator things like abortion bans can become. And I think we saw that in Poland as well. And I think there's something to be said of the fact that I don't think someone like Donald Tusk would have entered this race and returned to domestic politics if he didn't spy quite a significant chance that the opposition could oust the Law and Justice Party, because his political career doesn't need to just be revived on the off chance that we might be able to do this. So I think a lot of those things you described there led to the decision of Donald Tusk to think, you know what, the opposition could win this election and I could lead them back into power.
You talk about the US and, you know, it's hard not to draw parallels with the US, but that turnout of 74.4%, do you agree with me, Sam, that it kind of is similar to what we talked about, what juiced the 2020 US presidential election result, in the sense that you had a highly divided country, you had stark differences between two fundamentally different visions of Poland, and that sparked the big increase in people in turnout who, as many people, understood the consequences of it.
Yeah, and I think there's almost a better comparison as well with the Brazilian presidential election, because I think there's a lot of parallels to be drawn between the kind of campaign that Lula was running against Jair Bolsonaro and the kind of campaign Donald Tusk was running against Jaroslaw Kaczynski and the incumbent Law and Justice Party, because it was about a return to quote-unquote establishment normality against what they perceive to be a constitutional dismantling. So I think there's a good comparison to be drawn there as well.
And just quickly on the turnout point as well, you're absolutely right about that. But considering that, the fact that in the referendum, turnout was less than 50%, only 40% across the four questions, that to me was even more astonishing, is that people actually understood. Because I thought there'd be quite a lot of people who, I didn't expect that level of differential. Basically, almost one voter for every two that voted in the general election didn't vote in the referendum. Now, obviously, the referendum questions all were no. Listen to our preview episode for what the questions were, and you can understand why. But I didn't know it was interesting that the retirement age question got slightly more support, 5%, than all the other questions at 3-4%. And the retirement age questions where the polls supported the increase in restoration of the retirement age to 67, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, so I think there's no better illustration of the kind of cut through that the Tusk campaign managed to achieve in this environment than the fact that his plea to supporters of the opposition not to participate in the referendum paid off, because nearly half of the people who turned out in the election as a whole chose not to vote in the referendum, which I think demonstrates that it may have been an alleged unlevel playing field, but whatever the Tusk campaign was doing, or the Third Way campaign, or the Left campaign, clearly had an impact.
Yeah, and the results are not legally binding as a result, so they can just free to do whatever they like because turnout was that low. I did think that Donald Tusk, I remember a quote from Election Day that stuck with me, and I didn't write it down, but I've always remembered it. It's, this is the happiest I've been by coming second, is what he told his supporters. And I think with good reason, we can understand why.
Exactly. But Chern, what happens next in Poland? Because it's incredibly likely that we will be having an opposition-led government. And it's pretty likely that we know exactly what that will look like, because in the past few weeks, the three main opposition parties, the Civic Coalition, the Left, and the Third Way, have basically signed the very beginnings of a coalition agreement. But we may not be seeing a Donald Tusk premiership for quite some time, will we?
No, I think the estimates everyone's expecting is mid-December, because President Duda, who is a close ally of the PIS leader, Jaroslaw Kaczynski, is trying to push the constitution to its limit, but will not break it, unlike Donald Trump, to try and ensure that PIS remains in power for a little bit longer. He's already announced that Parliament will return on November 13, but crucially, he decides who he will nominate to be the Prime Minister candidate. Now, he has said in the past that he will get the leader of the largest party in the SEEM to form the government, to get first shot at forming a government, which is incumbent Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the PIS. But we know that's not likely to happen. And if that is likely to be the case, everyone thinks will play out, they'll nominate PIS, they'll fall in a vote of confidence. Donald Tusk, elect government will be formed in around mid-December. That's what we are expecting. And it will likely consist, Sam. Or will it? We definitely know third way will be part of it. But I sent you a tweet earlier this week talking about potentially 9 PIS MPs who might quit the party and become independents, which would bring a PO with these 9 independents and third way over the majority line. Will they stick with the left? Or if these 9 MPs were to defect, would he leave the left out of this discussion?
It's certainly a possibility. I do, however, think that negotiating with an established political party long term is much easier than negotiating with 9 independents who potentially could have very different opinions on a variety of issues and could have very different motivations as to why they have crossed the floor from Law and Justice to the opposition. So I do think it's more likely that the left are involved, but it is an interesting potential twist in the tail as we head into coalition negotiations. So it will be interesting to see, because the big unknown in this, although we do know that Donald Tusk is going to be Prime Minister and we do think we know what the government's going to look like, is we don't entirely know what this platform is going to look like, because the Civic Coalition, they're part of the European People's Party, the Poland 2050, which comes as part of the Third Way group, is part of Renew Europe, and the left is part of the European Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. So these are 3 political parties who come from different European ideological traditions and have slightly different reasons why they oppose the Law and Justice Party. Now, I don't think this is going to be as extreme as the, like, Naftali Bennett rainbow coalition formed against Benjamin Netanyahu. It's nowhere near that. But it's not far away, and we could potentially be seeing a situation where, yes, they're unified in opposing the Law and Justice Party, but when it comes to what their governing platform is going to be, beyond reversing erosion of democratic norms and capture of the judicial system and the constitution, etc., when it comes to day-to-day governance, these parties might not see eye to eye on everything. So I am waiting with bated breath to see what this coalition agreement looks like, because I think it could be pretty interesting.
Just look at Germany, for example, the 3-way coalitions that might not work or like each other very much. You're absolutely right. I did actually write here Israel 2021 as, you know, that glue that binds the coalition together, that joint aversion to the democratic backsliding under the 2 consecutive PIS that government is holding it together. And even the democratic backsliding angle, I think it'll be very difficult, because you got President Duda in power for a little while longer.
For at least 18 months.
And he will probably try as much to frustrate as possible. And to undo all the judges that they have appointed to all the various courts will take time, as President Biden is finding out right now. So I just think it'll be a long roll. It's not just flick a switch, you flip a government. Yes, you can start to undo that, but I just think the process will be very long as well. With 3 issues I found my research to divide this government: abortion, housing, and protection for farmers over. And that could have knock-on implications for the extent of Poland's support for the war in Ukraine, because Polish farmers are insisting that the current protectionist measures on grain remain in place. So there's a lot of policy to be worked out. We saw that 3-party coalitions can be uncomfortable. It remains to be seen about the extent to which these 3 parties work together. But I think you're right. They're ideologically closer to each other than they are in Israel. So I think there's a slightly better chance of this government surviving its 4-year term. Sam, just very quickly, I just want to talk before we round off and give our takeaways, as we always do. A note of Confederation, because I think that's interesting, because we talked about the appeal of Confederation and why Third Way overperformed. Do you have any thoughts in that one?
I have a feeling that a lot of this comes down to people being afraid that the Law and Justice Party government was under threat, and people who potentially flirted with the idea of voting for Confederation decided when push comes to shove on election day that they were going to row in behind the Law and Justice Party to try and ensure that they remained in control of the government, because I can't see the Confederation voters voting for any of the opposition parties because they're just ideologically miles away from each other. But nor can I see these voters deciding to stay at home because they just don't think it's worth turning out. So I think the likeliest outcome is that they rode in behind the United Right Coalition in anticipation that it was going to be difficult for the Law and Justice Party to cross the threshold.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. And just on the third wave of why overperform, I read that this could be a PIS shooting himself in his foot because he ran around for weeks saying that third wave were at risk of not even crossing the threshold, which we know that's blatantly not true if you look at the opinion polls. And maybe that juiced extra people to come and vote for them, extra motivated to vote for third way. I also wonder whether they are potentially a more centrist option appeal for people who are sick of the PISP or duopoly of Polish politics over the last 20 years. I sent you a screenshot of 2007. We saw Donald Tusk versus Jarosław Kaczyński. 20 years later, it's still the same two faces. And I did note as well that the leader of Poland 2050 did a very good debate performance in the only TV debate. So that could have helped as well. And there was a mass mobilization of that Donald Tusk-led Million Heart March. That could have all helped explain third wave's overperformance. But Sam, to close off, your reflections on these two remarkable sets of elections.
Yeah, I mean they're very different in some senses, but I guess the thread that combines the two of them is it's a victory for the opposition, a pretty commanding victory for the opposition in a landscape that within the last term has seemed pretty much nailed on for the incumbent government to do pretty well. In New Zealand, that was the fact that Jacinda Ardern absolutely blew the National Party out of the water 3 years ago with New Zealand's first overall majority in a mixed member proportional environment. And then on the Polish side, you had the Law and Justice Party having two consecutive overall majorities and allegedly unleveling the playing field by capturing state TV, capturing courts, and yet you still saw the opposition win in both of those environments, which I think is testament for if the will is there to get rid of the incumbent and the energy is with the opposition in terms of critiquing what the government has achieved over the last 3 years, then nothing can really stop it, whether it's the electoral advantage or the landscape advantage. And I think we saw that in both of these elections.
I 100% agree with that. Two more governments that have led their countries throughout the pandemic have lost. The shadow of COVID-19, even lockdowns 2 years ago, still continued to cast its impact on COVID. We saw that in how Labour performed in Auckland and in Poland. And regardless of the ideology of the current governments facing the polls, regardless of the opposition obstacles put in front of them, regardless of how they felt even 3 short years ago, I mean, just thinking of recording this podcast, as I said, on election night 2020 and seeing those results, the scale of the New Zealand Labour's landslide, to think 3 years later they would lose office, it's just unfathomable. And considering that both Helen Clark and John Key won third terms after the landslide second, I genuinely would not consider this outcome. When people now, Sam, very simply, are not in a forgiving mood. You know, they're suffering economically. They remember what their lives were like towards the goodwill of governments, you know, after 2020. They do remember all those second, third and consecutive lockdowns. And people have long memories, it clearly seems, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I you know how much I love talking about preferred prime minister polling and about how individuals, I think, are big motivations in cycles. Well, both of these elections prove that you don't actually have to be a phenomenally popular individual compared to your opposition to win the election. Because if the energy is on the side of change, it doesn't really matter who is the figurehead of that change, because change can just be a powerful motivator in itself. And I think both New Zealand and Poland demonstrated that, because Christopher Luxon and Donald Tusk, yes, they had high profiles, but they weren't particularly extraordinarily more popular than the other opposition that they were facing. So that's interesting as well.
Well, one thing that will not change is that we'll be back next week, isn't it, Sam?
Absolutely. So for now, that is it for the latest of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we'll be breaking down results from two presidential elections, one in Ecuador and the other in Argentina as it heads for its second round in a few weeks' time. As always, we'll continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.